I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is the Jack Pod, our weekly special drop where On Point news analyst Jack Beattie helps us connect history, literature, and politics in a way that brings unique clarity to the world we live in now. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
Well, today it's episode 8 of the Jack Pod. And Jack, usually this is the point at which I ask you about the headline for today's episode, but I'm going to break protocol this time because I already know that you want to talk about Wednesday's awful mass shooting in Lewiston, Maine, where at least 18 people were killed and 13 injured. Now, this is the 565th mass shooting in the United States this year. That's according to a nonprofit data collection group called the Gun Violence Archive. And so, Jack, I thought, given the grim consistency of mass shootings in this country, what more or what new could be said? But you've got something for us.
Well, it's just that, you know, there was a book published about Iraq 20-odd years ago with the title Republic of Fear. Well, I don't know whether it fits Iraq then, or it certainly did under Saddam Hussein, but it fits America now, doesn't it? We are a republic of fear. And why is that? Because the state has failed in its, the government has failed in its fundamental responsibility, which is to protect the citizenry. In his myth of the social contract, Thomas Hobbes says, what is life without the state? What is life before civil society? And he says, it is a war of everyone against everyone, a state of continual fear and danger of violent death, and the life of man solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Men and women escape from that condition in Hobbes's myth by forming a social contract. They agree to give over some of their freedom to the sovereign, the Leviathan state, and in return, the state will protect them from the anarchy and violence and fear of the state of nature. But it isn't assured that the civil power can do that. And when it collapses, when the civil state fails in its obligation to protect people, we return, in effect, to a state of nature where we fear each other, where we arm ourselves, and where we recognize that, you know, the indicting truth that we are not safe. The government is not protecting us.
Mm. Now, Leviathan, written in, what, 1650-ish, right? And my fading memory on this, though, recalls that, as you mentioned, Jack, Hobbes's theory was that because of the terror of the brutish state of man, that the social contract involved the people giving up some of their rights in order, in exchange for that, like you said, the protection uniquely provided by the state. So doesn't it require within that social contract an agreement amongst those who constitute the state what it means to protect the people? I'm not sure we have that anymore.
No, and in specifically, look at these semi-assault weapons, the AR-15, which apparently was the weapon used in this massacre shooting. The government, you know, they're 1 in 20 Americans now has one of these, and they multiply the fatality and injury that one person can inflict on many. And therefore, they're a classic case of, you know, the violation of rights, of everybody's rights, by just a tiny, by the one person with the gun. And the government did, you know, put a ban on this for 10 years or more. And then that ban under George W. Bush and under the Democratic Congress, I believe, was allowed to lapse. And ever since the gun now is called America's gun. And the portrait of its owners in the Washington Post, they did a study of people that own them. Well, the owner's a white male, 40 to 60. They have a higher income than normal. Most have served in the military, and most are Republicans. According to the Post study, only 10% of Democrats own an AR-15. A proper government, a government that was living up to its part of the social contract, would have banned this weapon and bought out this weapon, as happened in Australia and in New Zealand, and made an effort to protect us. Mm. But we all know it hasn't. And it isn't so much that we're all going to be exposed to this kind of violence. It is that we know the government isn't doing anything to protect us from it.
Mm-hmm. By the way, as a quick aside, the story of America's relationship with firearms is the subject of a really good new podcast series from our home station, WBUR. That podcast is called The Gun Machine. So if you haven't already, folks, definitely go and check it out and subscribe to it as the episodes get published, because it's all related, right? This is a long history that you're talking about, Jack. But I keep hearing those numbers and those statistics around AR-15 or AR-15 type weapon ownership. I keep coming back to your very insightful recalling of Hobbes, right? Because again, in that case, Hobbes says it's the state that's supposed to protect us. But in the United States, for quite a while, there has also been this ethos of, well, we need to be protected from the state, right? I mean, even yes. in the NRA's mid-20th century history, there was a NRA leader who infamously said that, you know, if people die, that's the price for freedom. That's the price of freedom, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. It's a reverse of the Hobbes idea. We are fearful of the state because we're giving up too much liberty to it. And there's something else involved. You know, Max Weber, in his essay, Politics as a Vocation, lays out, he says, for what is specific to the present is that all other organizations or individuals can assert the right to use physical violence only insofar as the state permits them to do so. The state is regarded as the sole source of the right to use violence. He says the state is the form of human community that successfully lays claim to the monopoly of legitimate physical violence. Quoting Max Weber, well, that is and now I'm quoting Stuart Stevens, in his new book, The Conspiracy to End America. He's a former Republican political consultant and headed up, Mitt Romney's campaign. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he writes that Republicans reject that Weberian idea that the state is the only legitimate user-wielder of violence. And, quote, they have convinced themselves that they live in a dark and dangerous world under constant threat. And he says, while other Western democracies focus on putting computers in classrooms, America is putting guns in classrooms, arming administrators. And then he says, surrounding children with armed protection is how drug lords try to protect their children, not a functioning democracy. He makes the point that just the NRA is making, you got to protect yourself. The state won't do it. And frankly, isn't that true? The state won't. The state isn't. And what's the only alternative? Unilateral disarmament? I mean, the logic of getting your gun and having it with you is, it seems to me, inexorable. You can't deny that if the social contract is broken, that if, in effect, we're back in a state of nature, get me my gun.
Mm. You know, Jack, we keep saying the state, the state. And if memory serves, there's an illustration with Hobbes's book, The Leviathan, of, you know, the massive monster of the state, right? It's various tentacles reaching into every part of life. But at the head of that monstrous figure of the state is a monarchical head, right? But we don't.
That's right.
That's not what we have. We have, as you've mentioned so accurately, we have a democracy here. So there isn't necessarily one sole ruler we can look at and say, you are failing in your duty to protect the people. Because we have parties and individuals of very, very sharply divided views over firearms. Like, you know, I'm thinking about there's been reporting since Wednesday when the awful shootings happened that, in fact, the suspect in the Lewiston, Maine shootings was a U.S. Army reservist, or it is a U.S. Army reservist, whose commanders have reportedly said that in mid-July, so just this summer, they had deep concerns that he was acting erratically while the unit was training. And in fact, New York State Police took the suspect to a community hospital actually at West Point for evaluation. Now, so that brings up this question of, you know, red flag laws, because every time there's a mass shooting like this, lots of people stand up and say the gun isn't the problem, the shooter's the problem, and must have had a mental illness. But even in those cases where there were alerts beforehand, because of the way red flag laws are structured, it's extraordinarily difficult to get someone put on that list so they cannot own a firearm in the future. So no matter what people say, they are creating policy that will not even allow something as simple as background checks or verifiable concerns about a person's mental stability to prevent them from owning a deadly weapon, Jack.
Yes. So even when laws have been passed, when the government, the state has, you know, broken out of its inertia and passed laws, they aren't enforced. They aren't enforced with anything like the tenacity that the crisis requires. Because what's at stake is the legitimacy of the state. Everything is at stake. If, you know, it isn't just a matter of, and then you read about the bureaucratic hurdles that people have to go through. Well, you've got to get the warrant and you've got to do this. And meanwhile, time goes by. We had a program about how, there's a boyfriend sort of loophole in these laws that if, you know, in a domestic situation, a marriage situation, a red flag law, yeah, in some theoretical way, can take the gun away. It doesn't do it much. But there is no even theoretical way if it's just a boyfriend. Mm-hmm. There's a loophole in the law. And we did a touching story, I think, about a Missouri woman who was murdered by her boyfriend while, you know, waiting to see if the state would protect her from his predictable, foreseeable violence. And it wouldn't, because he's a boyfriend.
Yeah. And that I'm so glad that you pointed out that show, Jack, because we learned a lot of things about the Swiss cheese nature of these laws, because the woman who got murdered, who you mentioned, she had already had a restraining order put on her boyfriend, her ex-boyfriend, because he had demonstrated that he was violent towards her. And she was vocally fearful that he was going to kill her. And so she and her mother tried to get him put on a list so that he could not purchase future firearms, because as a known committer of domestic violence, they had to go to the FBI. The FBI couldn't get it done. They had to go to the Department of Homeland Security. They had to call members of Congress. And still, it was next to impossible, as I keep saying, to get someone like that put on the list. Very, very good and chilling example, Jack. But on the flip side, again, thinking of your example of what is the state's duty and do people feel safe in the failure of the duty of the state, which, as you're saying, that failure has been brought about by various members of the state itself. But there was someone that you wanted to talk about that really kind of is eye-opening regarding Americans' actual fears and what leads them to buy the kinds of firearms we've been talking about. You wanted to talk about David French, right?
Yes, David French. He's a columnist for the New York Times, but he's really a kind of model public intellectual, a kind of public philosopher. Reading his columns, you feel that this is a wise person. I mean, there's no flippancy. There's just intelligence and compassion and steady reason. So I was surprised to hear him say on NPR that he, in fact, owns a gun.
And we've got a cut of that interview. It was David French speaking with NPR's Rachel Martin.
One of the things that the Second Amendment does is it protects your right of self-defense. So, for example, you know, my family has been under threat off and on for several years. And
Because of your writing and,
yes,
and different issues you've taken a position on, yes.
Yes. And in that circumstance, I feel like I have to defend myself against a foreseeable threat. And the foreseeable threat is a person who possesses either a semi-automatic rifle or a semi-automatic pistol. And so that's what we use to defend our family, is a semi-automatic rifle at home. And then when you carry a weapon, a semi-automatic pistol.
You have that in your home, David?
Yes, absolutely.
An AR-15 style.
Yes,
weapon.
Yes.
And it makes you feel safer.
It makes me safer. It's not just a feeling. It's a reality. It does make me safer.
So, Jack, did it surprise you that French said, it makes me safer?
It did. I mean, it seemed, and he insisted on it, as you heard. It makes him safer. I guess he's thinking of a situation of siege where people come in and therefore he can, you know, he can outshoot them with his AR-15. I mean, that is to say, if it's one thing to say, it makes me fear less, but he says it makes me safer. That it's almost like he's at the state of imagining a siege where he can, in fact, outshoot the person coming in to do his family harm. And what was shocking to me about it is, you know, it's easy to identify with this bookish, writer, you know, and I'm thinking, my God, should I arm up? It's like there's a certain subset of people that he would be he'd be kind of a leader for. I mean, is this what we need to do? And would that make us safer? And of course, everything we read says it makes you less safe because, of course, the deadly chance of suicide is always there. The chance of someone stealing the gun is always there. The chance of a child, oh my God, just think of that, getting a hold of the gun. So I don't think it makes you safer. I think the data says that, but you can't, if even a man like that is arming up, what does it say about the rest of us?
So, Jack, one more question about, that social contract and the state not being able to fulfill it by not keeping people safe. Another part of that era's thinking about the duty of government is that the state is given so much power by virtue of the consent of the governed, right? But, there's lots of evidence, lots of polling that shows that for a couple of key issues when it comes to guns in the United States, there actually is quite a bit of public consensus. People want red flag laws. People want background checks. At least in those two areas, there's overwhelming support for that. And yet there's a deep vein of resistance in Congress for enacting those very things, because of the influence of the gun lobby, because of the influence of a certain set of very, very devoted defenders of the current interpretation of the Second Amendment. All of that is to say, is this not potentially a case in which the state is acting in a way that is not via the consent of the governed in America?
Well, that's another departure from the democratic model of the social contract, isn't it? A minority, we talk about minority rule in America, the Senate, the Supreme Court, the drift of the Republican Party directly to minority rule, gerrymandering, all the rest. Here's a flagrant instance of it where, I've seen 80% want universal back. The numbers are, as you say, overwhelming. You get into about the 60s when you talk about assault weapon ban, but still 60, that's a lot, 60% of the people. But the government isn't responding. Minority rule, and not just minority rule, but rule by this fear-generating and exceedingly, from what all the reporting indicates, corrupt and seemingly flailing organization, the National Rifle Association, the grip they have on the Republican Party seems almost unbreakable. And And so we have the situation of fear. We have the situation of mass violence. And then what do we have? We had Trump coming along saying, I alone can fix it. He's telling his people government has failed. And that really sets the precedent for violent action by non-government actors.
Okay, Jack. Well, listeners to the Jack Pod now are starting to see bright threads throughout the different topics that you address every week. And this is a perfect example of that, because one of your listeners, Aaron Pacey from Erie, Pennsylvania, left us a message about episode 6 from a couple of weeks ago when you talked about kakistocracy, right? Or government by the least qualified, if I can put it that way. And Aaron wanted to tell you that, yes, for him, it's possible that if Donald Trump is elected again, he might take action on a certain plan that he has. And this is what that plan is.
My wife and I are currently looking at what it takes to move out of America. Because if Donald Trump wins, that's what we're doing. We're taking our two kids, one high school, one middle school age, and we're leaving.
Okay. Now, it might seem like, well, that's quite extreme, and maybe he's just saying it and won't do it. But then he went on, Jack, to tell us about why. Why they're even thinking about leaving the country if Trump wins again. And so Aaron told us, his answer is it has a lot to do with violence.
If he becomes president, it's going to be bloody here in America, whether it's going to look like Ireland during the Troubles or the American Civil War in some way. I don't know. But I mean, there's no way it doesn't get bloody. And I'm not willing to die fighting Trump and his MAGA millions. I'm not willing to die. And I'm not willing to have my family die for it. So we're looking online, how do you leave America?
Jack, what do you think?
God, I'm sure how many people must feel the same thing. Of course, I can remember people saying that about Richard Nixon. But boy, I mean, you could hear the conviction and the fear in his voice. You know, he mentions models of this, Northern Ireland, where and the American Civil War. But here's the problem. We're all mixed up in America today. In his county, Erie County, for example, Biden got 66,000 votes. Trump got 65,000. That is to say, every other person there is with Trump. You can't even begin to talk about any sort of civil conflict. Even in Northern Ireland, you know, the communities were separated. Segregation was the rule, not in America. Even in California, Trump got 6 million votes. There's no geographic basis for anything even like a civil war, but civil disturbance, riots, violence, mayhem, everywhere would seem to be possible. And, you know, he mentions the case of Trump winning. Well, it seems certain to me that Trump will not accept losing. And, of course, that brings out the question of would there be mass violence on the other side, not from Trump supporters, but from people that are just demanding that democracy work. And what effect will that have? And, of course, now we have if the Republicans are reelected, and if there's a tie in the Electoral College, we have Mike Johnson would be very happy to deliver the House of Representatives to Donald Trump as a new president. So the dangers that could prompt someone to leave are just so there. You can't exaggerate them. You know, there's a phrase from Coleridge, the imagination of disaster. Here's Trump being insouciant about voting, because voting, it's as if he doesn't even, not even thinking about the election. I'm not going to accept it no matter what the result is.
Then we had a little election that went astray. So we have to be careful. You got to get out there and you got to watch those voters. You don't have to vote. Don't worry about voting. The voting, we got plenty of votes. You got to watch election night. You know, it used to be election day, election night. Now it's election month. Now it's election period. Some of these things going for 53 days. It's terrible.
She's telling his people, don't worry about voting. We're not going to deal with anything so mundane. We're just going to say we won.
Well, Jack, Aaron wasn't the only person who had some follow-up questions or thoughts for you by listening to a Jackpod from the past. I want to take this moment to remind folks that we really, really do value you being in conversation with Jack through sending us your thoughts and comments to the Jackpod. So for this week, we want to know from you, what do you think about Jack's referencing of Thomas Hobbes and the Leviathan about how the state has failed in its duty to keep the people safe? And so therefore, that potentially is one explanation for why gun ownership and specifically AR-15s is so high in this country. Just curious what you think about that. So we would love it if you could send us your comments via the On Point Vox Pop app. And if you don't already have it, just go to wherever you get your apps and look for On Point Vox Pop, because as you can tell, we do listen to every single one of them. And Jack, speaking of, we're going to take a quick break here, but we got a lot of comments from regarding last week's pod, where you talked about pathologizing in American politics. So we'll hear from those listeners in just a moment.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Well, we're back with the Jackpod, and of course, it's with Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. And on last week's episode, Jack, you talked about the dubious history of pathologizing presidential candidates in terms of their state of mental health. And specifically, you talked about how that's happening with former President Donald Trump and President Joe Biden.
I mean, I can't even imagine having to talk on in front of people all the time, and any little mistake you have is going to make you fair game to be the identified patient of the hour.
Now, that's Jackpod listener Jessica Levy from Dunedin, Florida. And here's a little bit more of what she had to say.
Whether it be gossip or a frustration with someone in our life, there's always a way to parlay that into some sort of disorder. And in politics or in pop culture, this is absolutely no different, especially currently with how mainstream mental health discussions have become. It is super commonplace to read a quick description of a mental disorder and then apply it to somebody that we know or hear about.
So I gather from that Jessica is saying we do it to everybody, not just politicians, and most likely inappropriately so. Now, here's another comment from Kyle Joyner. Kyle's from Helena, Montana, and is a former mental health therapist.
I think one of the problems with past, but more importantly, the contemporary use of psychiatric name-calling is that oftentimes media or other pundit figures do not define the terminology that they are throwing around. For example, in your segment, you used the term narcissist. Well, you didn't define what that is or what that would mean. And could you essentially pick out a couple of people on the street and ask them at random what they think a narcissist is, and would you get the right definition? This is, I think, a major problem.
Okay, Jack, what do you think?
Well, on narcissism, I quite take that point. And yet, the myth of Narcissus, right, is a myth about human behavior and about self-love and about illusion. It's about character and how that is undermined by our own self-infatuation. In other words, it's a loaded term psychiatrically, and of course, that sort of, in a way, it says, well, that person doesn't have much agency, they're just a malignant narcissist, just acting out, rather than this person is morally responsible, blinded by self-love, and you know, we need to reclaim the psychiatric lingo. We need to reclaim all that for moral judgment. Dr. Johnson puts it very well. We are moralists by necessity and geometricians only by chance. We're therapists only by chance. We have to be moralists all the time, concerned with the question of how to live.
Wow. Okay, Jack. So you offer such a richness in the Jackpod that people are really listening very, very carefully to what you say. And I'm going to give you this example from a comment we received from Paul Kenyon, who's in Bridgeport, Vermont. And Paul really picked up on your mentioning of the Goldwater rule regarding how, you know, that psychiatrists or psychologists wouldn't publicly comment on the mental health of a political candidate. And he picked up on that, and here's what Paul proposed.
I wish to offer what should be a corollary of the Goldwater rule, which limits psychiatric name-calling. As Magnus said, the Goldwater rule prohibits a member of the professional psychiatric community from offering psychological opinions about individuals whom they had not personally examined. Please recognize the parallel between the Goldwater rule and what limits scientific consensus. The only scientific consensus is that among people who are intimately familiar with the specific aspect of the science being discussed.
Huh. I'm not sure what I think of that, Jack, so I'll just hand it off to you.
Well, if I think about climate change in that way, I'm a little alarmed. Is Paul suggesting that we can't talk, we can't debate, we can't, we have to leave that to the scientists because it's too much for us. We only the experts can speak about it. That worries me a great deal. I think the difference is this: the psychiatric name calling has a terrible history in the Soviet Union and for that matter in Nazi Germany and in this country with terrible violations of civil liberties. So it goes right to the question of human dignity. And you deny that to people with these psychiatric labels. I don't think that's true of any other of these scientific matters. The public, I think, should debate them. I don't think we should just say, you know, climate change is too important for the climate scientists. It is. We all have to debate it, and I'm afraid the idea of a sort of, let the experts talk. We don't, you know, they need to represent their own consensus, and we can't get into it. If I'm reading Paul correctly, that would worry me, and just in terms of that one issue of climate change.
Interesting, and I'll offer this, that if Paul, if that is indeed what you are suggesting, consensus can only be had amongst a narrow band of experts, well, then that just pulls the rug out from my entire reason for being the host of On Point, because I'm not an expert in anything, but always eager to hear and learn from others. Well, that was a very, very dense and rich podcast for us this week, Jack. So I blanch at asking you if you know what you've got in store for next week.
Well, I thought we would talk about immigration and specifically about the Immigration Act of 1965. It is a classic case of unintended consequences.
Okay, so that's for next week. Not giving yourself a break, I see, Jack, but that's it for this week's Jackpod. Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.